Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a great honour and privilege to welcome you all here to the Mackenzie Stewart Lecture. As many of you know, the Centre for European Legal Studies CELS hosts an annual public lecture in honour of Lord Mackenzie Stewart, who was the first British judge to be the president at the Court of Justice in Luxembourg. And there have been a number of very eminent scholars and judges who have given this lecture over the years. Now, this year's speaker is my wonderful friend and colleague, Annan Menon, Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London and Director of the academic think tank UK in a Changing Europe and a regular voice in Britain's public debate. He is a social media star and a traditional media star. He's even made some very watchable TikTok videos. Via UK and a Changing Europe, Annan has done three remarkable things. First, he explains the issues around Brexit with clarity, pizzazz, and humour. He's made complex political, economic, and dare I say it, even legal issues accessible, clear and engaging. As one admirer of his work says, he doesn't shout or posture or moralise, but he does insist on facts, on fairness and on precision, and most of all on usefulness. His work is a public service. He writes to help people see things they might otherwise miss, to name dynamics, name power and name consequences. Second, he's shown academia that there is a different way of engaging with the public. He has given impact, such a buzzword in our circles, a new meaning. He's shown how it's possible to translate academic literature, which might be read by a few dozen people, into a 1,000-word blog, which is accessible and read by many thousands of people. He's shown too how in the vexed terrain of Brexit and beyond, it's possible to take an impartial stand and present facts. In the run-up to the referendum, I think I spent more time with Annan than I did with my own family doing town halls up and down the country. I never knew which way Annan was going to vote until the 23rd of June. He's engaged with hundreds of politicians, civil servants, and thousands of members of the public. This engagement may be thought seen through his writing, his appearances on Question Time, and even on the news quiz. Third, he's given a new meaning to interdisciplinarity. He's shown how political scientists, economists, geographers, lawyers can all work together, not in a tokenistic way, but where the whole is more than the sum of its parts. He's also incredibly generous. He's shown generations of academics how to bring his magic to their work. He's also brave, taking on some of the worst on social media and calling it out. I'm very proud to call him my friend. I've learned a great deal from him, and I fully expect to learn a lot more this evening. Annan, the floor is yours.
She's never normally that nice about me. I've come over all emotional. So, I mean, thinking about it, I've spent most of the last 12 years sort of studying Brexit up close and personal. And a lot of it, as Catherine said, in her company. And just thinking sort of on my way over here about some of the moments we've lived through. There are three moments in particular with Catherine that stick in my mind about the Brexit story. And they all, I think, concern her ability to keep a poker face while being appalled. The first was on the 24th of June, 2016, when we were at College Green with all the tents set up and whatever, and Catherine was sitting in the Radio 5 tent next to Jeremy Corbyn, as he said, "Well, we might as well just trigger Article 50 this morning and get it done with." And Catherine's mouth twitched a little bit, but she kept that poker face. The next time was about 2 or 3 years later. We were in the House of Commons. And we were listening to a presentation by the then Dexiu minister, Suella Braverman. Suella was blissfully unaware that Catherine was in the audience. And I asked her, because I was chairing the session, at what point did you start becoming a Eurosceptic? And Suella said, oh, I think it was when I was a student at Cambridge listening to lectures on the European Court of Justice by Catherine Barnard. Absolutely priceless. And the third was in 2019. We were on the day of the, those of you above a certain age will remember the indicative votes. And on the day of the indicative votes, Rory Stewart rang me up and said, could a couple of you come in and explain to my colleagues what all this means? And so Catherine and I, plus one other, went into the House of Commons. There's a room packed. I mean, think about this. This is after 3 years of negotiating and talking about this. There's a room packed with MPs. And the first guy puts his hand up and said, the problem with the customs union is it means freedom of movement, doesn't it? So we can't do that. Again, that familiar twitch of the mouth as Catherine tried not to say what she was really thinking. And actually, next June marks the 10th anniversary of the referendum. So I've started trying to think things through and to make sense of it all. And I know that Ivan Rogers came to Cambridge, not for this lecture, but for another one in about 2017, I think, and talked about the Brexit revolution. And he was talking about the revolution in relations between the UK and the EU. I want to talk about a different Brexit revolution. I want to apologise to all those who've come here expecting a law lecture. I'm not a lawyer, so there isn't going to be much law in what I'm talking about. I want to talk about the Brexit revolution in our politics, how it happened, what it means for us now. And insofar as I've got an argument, arguments are a bit like methods. They're things you need before you get tenure. And actually, so I'm going to play a bit fast and loose. I mean, if you're a young academic, I'm really sorry, but you have to play by the rules, but I'm too old to worry now. Insofar as I have an argument, I suppose it comes in several bits. Firstly, you can't understand Brexit without understanding the long-term dissatisfaction that had built up in this country for a significant period of time beforehand. Secondly, Brexit's impact on politics was huge, and one of those impacts was actually to provide us with a unique window of opportunity to finally address those problems. Third, it was the failure to do so, and the failure to do so quite dramatically, that in a sense explains where we've reached today in terms of our politics, with faith in mainstream politics shattered, with reform ahead in the polls. Brexit, in other words, is both cause and consequence of a lot of what's going on in our politics today. And in what follows, I'm going to try and just briefly talk you through it. So there is the outline of what I'm going to talk about. We hear a lot about how the problems we face in our country are down either to Brexit or to, as the phrase goes, 14 years of Conservative government. The fact of the matter is, popular dissatisfaction with the status quo dates back far, far longer than that. In 2001, when Tony Blair was re-elected for the first time, Labour lost 3 million votes. If you trace those voters through the British election study, insofar as you can, a lot of them floated off to UKIP, and those who were left tended to vote for Boris Johnson in 2019. Those 3 million voters were a massive chunk of the new Labour electorate, and they fled. 4 years later, in 2005, Labour lost a third of its remaining voters. And work done by the Hansard Society at the time made it clear the reason why people were not voting Labour, the reason why people weren't voting, and 2025 saw Labour elected on the lowest vote share of any government until Keir Starmer's. The reason why people were fleeing was not because they thought Labour was going to win, but because they thought the parties were too similar and you couldn't trust politicians to deliver. This was way back at the start of this century. Now, of course, despite all of this, our electoral system meant that no one noticed. They lost 3 million votes in 2001, but only lost 6 seats. They hemorrhaged votes again in 2005, but still were re-elected with a majority of 66. But the fact is, there was a sense of dissatisfaction with how we were being governed, with what politics was doing, with the lack of choice between our political parties, all the way back at the start of this century. And this growing dissatisfaction, this disillusionment, was turbocharged by two things that happened during towards the end of that first decade. The first, of course, was the expenses crisis. We don't talk about it much anymore, but the expenses crisis was a seismic event that fundamentally shaped and reshaped attitudes towards politics. Just to remind you, 5 Labour MPs and 2 Tory peers were sentenced to between 12 and 18 months in prison On top of that, around 250 MPs were forced to pay back a total of £1.2 million. And of course, this played out against the backdrop of the other crisis that had started the previous September with the collapse of Lehman's, which was the great financial crisis. There's hardly a worse time to watch MPs being shamed for claiming money for their duck house or their moat than during the great financial crisis, but that's what's happened. And the impact of the great financial crisis was eye-watering. GDP in the course of 1 year shrank by 6%, and the effects were persistent. 10 years later, in 2018, our economy was a mere 11% bigger than it had been in 2008. It was 16% smaller than it should have been if prior growth trends had continued. And, crucially, the impact of the financial crisis, like the impact of so much else in our politics, was massively unequal. Prosperous places with high productivity, with well-educated workforces, suffered far, far less than poorer parts of the country. I remember being absolutely amazed because in my sort of daily commute from Oxford to London, there was absolutely no trace of a financial crisis or any impact of our economy. I remember going back up home to West Yorkshire in about 2010, 2011, and half the house high street was boarded up. That, in a way, symbolized the impact of the great financial crisis. It was massively unequal and hit the poorer places worse. And this, of course, was exacerbated by a choice, which was the choice of the Conservative Liberal coalition 2010 to 2015 to impose austerity. Now, I think the case has been pretty clearly made subsequent to that, that deciding to impose stringent cuts on the state at a time when, as Paul Johnson, who until recently was director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, put it, borrowing was cheap as chips, was the wrong choice. The way it was carried out merely added to that pre-existing inequality that I've already talked about. £30 billion were removed from the welfare budget. The impact of austerity, it's been shown in research in the last 4 or 5 years, had an overall negative impact on life expectancy in the country as a whole, and massively exaggerated differences in life expectancy between different parts of the country. On top of which, the cuts to local council funding, which we are living through the consequences of now, were absolutely severe. The particularly worst hit places, Barnsley, Liverpool, Wakefield, Blackburn, saw cuts of up to 40% in a period of 6 years in their council funding. And finally, adding to this picture of growing and stark economic inequality, something we don't talk about enough, quantitative easing, which might have been a rational response to the financial crisis in economic terms, was also a response that had grossly unequal impacts. It was being called by one economist the greatest ever redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich. The richest 10% of households benefited from QE about 100 times more than the poorest. The asset owners, those of us who own houses, benefited hugely from quantitative easing, and the rest of the population paid the price. So the economic picture was quite stark. But on top of that, as disillusionment bubbled away in the run-up to the 2015 election, something else became clear too, which was inequality was as much political as economic. In that election, UKIP won 4 million votes, give or take, and gained one seat. The SNP won, so UKIP won 13% of the national vote and got one MP. The SNP won 5% of the national vote and got 56 MPs. There's an inbuilt inequality in political terms about our electoral system as much as there was about our economy. And by that election of 2015, we find the British Social Attitudes Survey finding about a quarter of the population saying it's not worth voting. I remember a woman in Sunderland when we were out and about in the referendum saying to me, why vote? She said to me, you could stick a red rosette on a donkey in this town and it would win. Voting makes no difference. You have no real choice. This was the time, for those of you who remember, of that famous interjection by Russell Brand. Why would you vote? They're all the same. And there was a wonderful piece in The Guardian by the comedian Bridget Christie in about 2013, when she was writing about Andrew Lloyd Webber, Lord Lloyd Webber, and the fact that he rarely, if ever, bothered coming back to the House of Lords to vote. And she pointed out that there were two times he came back to vote. One was to remove working tax credits from poorer people, and the second was to vote in favour of gay marriage. And Bridget Christie wrote, he, in a way, typifies the zeitgeist of the time. he hates the poor and he loves queers. You have this sort of, and for the point of view of those people who were moving out of the electorate, who were getting dissatisfied with the politics, this hit the nail on the head. Remainia, as Guardian journalist Raphael Baer was to call it straight after the referendum, was that liberal economically and politically class that dominated and increasingly were at odds with a significant chunk of the British population. And again, of course, in 2015, First Past the Post did its job in the sense that it disguised this bubbling dissatisfaction that David Cameron was unwise enough to give full voice to the following year in the referendum. Now, I'm not here to argue that the referendum was a victory for the left behinds, because it wasn't. Only 21% of Leave voters had routine or semi-routine jobs. The middle class comprised almost 60% of Leave voters. But what the referendum did do is mobilise what you might call the left outs, the people who didn't usually participate in politics. 3 million people voted in 2016 who could have voted in 2015 but didn't. And the vast majority of those 3 million turned out and voted Leave. There are some turnout figures that shows that in places where actually there was a growing apathy about normal politics, people turned out en masse because of the belief that in a referendum where all votes count equally, you can actually have your say and be listened to. So values were obviously key to the referendum result. I'm going to come back and talk about social values in a minute. But there was a real element of economic geography to this. That is a horrible chart that basically points out that places where median wages were lower were disproportionately likely to vote Leave. This is a far nicer way of showing it. Places that had a Pret voted Remain. Now, you get this, right? I mean, people who've been to Pret. Pret sets up in towns where people are rich, populations are diverse, they're generally young. Pret sets up in successful cities. Pret doesn't set up in the bits of the country that are suffering economically. And there is, as you'll see from this rather odd graph, quite a nice correlation between where Prets are and where Leave voters congregate. And this economic geography is absolutely fundamental to our political story. Just to give you another illustration, those black dots are the places least affected in terms of employment by the coronavirus crisis. You see a pattern here. It's self-reinforcing. The places that have suffered as a result of austerity, as a result of the great financial crisis, are the places that suffered most because of COVID, and they're the places that tended to vote Leave. There's a strong economic element to this. Now, of course, the referendum wasn't the end of Brexit. What we had instead was 3 or 4 years of utter turmoil and political gridlock. To be fair to parliamentarians, the reason why Parliament couldn't agree on Brexit was because Parliament was precisely as divided as we were. There was no stable majority, either among the British people or amongst parliamentarians, for any particular form of Brexit, and Parliament struggled to digest the result of the referendum. But the whole process over those few years had a revolutionary impact on our politics. The first impact was about what made people choose to vote the way they do. Peter Pulitzer, the Oxford political scientist, had written in the 1960s, "Class is the basis of British party politics. All else is embellishment and detail." That was absolutely the case until the referendum of 2016. You voted left versus right, and your vote was determined by your view of economics, the size of the state, the amount of redistribution, and things like that. What the referendum did was introduce this new divide that had been festering away in the background of our politics for a long time, but had never been given expression. In the referendum, it was given expression, Remain versus Leave. And if you were socially conservative, nothing to do with your economic values, it's everything to do with your worldview, what you think about the death penalty, what you think about whether kids should be disciplined more in school, your views on trans rights, on gay marriage, all those sorts of things. That was what divided us during the referendum. For those of you who are into popular culture, if you like Mrs. Brown's Boys, you voted Leave. If you don't like Mrs. Brown's Boys, you voted Remain. The younger members of the audience probably won't get that. But if you watch an episode of Mrs. Brown's Boys, this is about snobbery and worldviews. Okay, it's not about economic self-interest. And that is a massive change in terms of our politics, because that Brexit divide was carried over because those Leave and Remain tribes became settled, they became fixed identities. I remember we did some polling on leavers and remainers in about 2018, 2019, And we found that 55% of Remainers would refuse to rent a room in their house to someone who voted Leave. We found that 58% of Remainers would be very or quite upset if one of their kids decided to marry a Leaver. So these divisions became real. They became entrenched. They became part of our identity. It is the case still to this day that more people feel a Leave or Remain identity than feel an attachment to a political party. So this division was real, and it had a massive and immediate impact on our politics. So look at that. People don't switch between Labour and the Conservatives in general, or hadn't in our politics before 2017. More than one in 10 switched directly. 12% of the Tories who voted for David Cameron in 2015 voted for Jeremy Corbyn in 2017. We had to get used to saying things like Labour win Kensington, the Tories win Stoke, which you never thought, as a political scientist, you would ever have to say. And of course, those identities became real. And what happens during this period is the Conservatives basically become the party of Leave. So Conservative support among Leave voters had been about 40% prior to the referendum, was about 70% by the time you got to the 2017 election, and an eye-watering 80% by the time you get to the election of 2019. Politics divided along Brexit lines, and that is why we got the complete remaking of the electoral geography of this country in the way we did. I apologize if you're at the back. I'm sure someone can email you these slides at some point if you want to look at them. The basic bottom, the takeaway from this is that basically the Tories nicked Leave voters in the 2019 election. The Remain camp was very divided amongst a number of parties, SNP, Lib Dem and Labour, and the Tories managed to concentrate Leave voters, which is why they won. More people in the 2019 election, it's worth saying, voted for Leave, for Remain backing parties than for Leave backing parties. But the reason that Boris Johnson won is because the Leave backing party was the Conservatives, because of course Nigel Farage stood down in a number of seats to help the Conservatives out. And that impact, bizarrely enough, is still present in our politics now. No one talked about Brexit last year during the election campaign. Even UK and Changing Europe didn't really talk about Brexit because no one was interested during the election campaign last year. But despite that, voting and vote switching happened within Brexit blocks rather than between Brexit blocks. People, as a rule, didn't switch from a Remain-supporting party to a Leave-supporting party or vice versa. They switch within the Remain or the Leave blocks. And one of the reasons why Keir Starmer did as well as he did was, of course, that Reform split the Leave vote. So you had the inverse of what happened in 2019 and 2024. In 2024, the Remain vote was splintered, which meant that Boris Johnson could win. In 2024, you had the Leave camp that splintered between Reform and the Conservatives, which means that Labour managed to win at the ballot box. Though, as I'll come back to say, that victory was not perhaps as sweeping as the numbers in Parliament might suggest. Now, that was the first impact on politics, the realignment. It had realigned how people vote and how people think about politics. The second big change was in the language of politics. That quote at the top is from the Conservative Manifesto from 2017. The Conservative Manifesto of 2017 was about the most left-wing manifesto put forward by any governing party, I think, as far as I can remember, this century. If you read the Conservative Manifesto of 2017 and you read it blindfolded, you would have thought it was a Labour manifesto. Interestingly enough, a few months after that election, Theresa May went on to implement the energy price cap that Ed Miliband had suggested some years previously, which had been condemned as Marxist by David Cameron. So the parties started to change their ground. The Conservatives started to talk, as Theresa May did, about burning injustices, about the just about managing. The day after his election victory in 2019, Boris Johnson called in all the senior civil servants in Whitehall and said the whole government has to shift its focus to improving the lives of working class voters in the north of England who backed Brexit. The point of all this was, one of the impacts of Brexit was to make people talk about those economic inequalities that had driven Brexit in the first place. This is a good thing, right? It held out the real prospect that actually, whilst Brexit was going to make us poorer, because that's what happens if you make trade with your largest and nearest trading partner more difficult and more administratively complex, you become poorer. But at least it held out the prospect that we might become less unequal in the process. Our parties were both talking about the kinds of regional inequalities that no one had talked about for some time. There was genuine hope, I think, that actually some of that discontent that had manifested itself so obviously and so loudly in 2016 would finally be addressed. The problem, of course, is that lots was said, but virtually nothing was done. By the time Theresa May left office in 2019, several of the burning injustices that she had talked about had become even worse than they had been at the time she talked about them. There were some legitimate excuses for this. Parliament basically didn't govern us from 2016 to 2019. All they did was argue about Brexit. Then they had COVID. So we had a time when it was very, very hard to govern. Nonetheless, it is striking just how little progress was made on levelling up during Boris Johnson's term as Prime Minister. A lot of fine words, very little in the way of action. And perhaps the most egregious example, I showed you that quote from Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak buying into this idea that Brexit is about domestic renewal. It's about doing things differently at home. He made that comment in his party conference speech in Manchester in 2023. And 10 minutes later, he cancelled HS2. So there was a lot of fine words about this, but politicians failed to deliver. And as a consequence, what you get is a significant rise of distrust in politics amongst Leave voters, which was particularly sad because actually in the immediate aftermath of the referendum and of the 2019 election, you see Leave voters increasing their trust in British politics. Their faith in the ability of politics to deliver went up quite markedly in the wake of the 2019 election result because they finally felt like they were getting what they'd wanted for so long that had never been able to get through the ballot box before. And of course, Leavers' faith in politics tanked during that period when the Conservatives were failing to implement the promises that they had made. And again, this is perhaps the other sad thing, is whilst in 2019, 47% said there was a great deal of difference between the parties, the figure by 2024 was 12%. We had, if you like, gone back to the future to 2015. That same situation where people don't have any faith in politics to deliver, where people think that actually there is nothing to choose between the major parties. And the third aspect of Brexit in terms of its impact on our politics was that this long-term failure to deliver, and particularly the post-referendum failure to deliver, increased dissatisfaction with mainstream politics. And Brexit as a whole, I think, opened the door to populism and made populism seem more acceptable than it had hitherto seemed. Partly because even supposedly mainstream politicians became more willing to use overtly populist language. As early as the 2016 Conservative Party conference, Theresa May said, those who claimed Article 50 could only be triggered following a vote in Parliament were trying to subvert democracy. November, the following month, we have the Enemies of the People headline in the Daily Mail. We had Sajid Javid that same week suggesting on Question Time that judges had tried to frustrate the will of the British people. Over the next 3 years, the media was variously to refer to members of Parliament as saboteurs, as wreckers, as mutineers, and as traitors. The language changed. This is partly because we were having to live in a situation where Parliament, and a Parliament made up mainly of Remain supporters, was having to implement the outcome of a referendum. And so Parliament became an easy target for the ire of Brexiters who were able to say Parliament is trying to stop us implementing the will of the people. And in 2018, things got even weirder. Theresa May, as you might recall, negotiated her deal with the European Union. And rather than going to the tea rooms in the House of Commons to try and sell it to her colleagues, who were ultimately going to have to vote on it, and who ultimately, of course, didn't, she set off on a nationwide tour to persuade the British people that this was a good thing. It was a slightly bizarre spectacle, only surpassed, I think, by what happened after she started to lose the votes in Parliament when she appeared on our television in a remarkably populist sort of intervention, said, voters are tired of the infighting, tired of the political games and the arcane rows, tired of MPs talking about nothing but Brexit. Parliament had done everything possible to avoid a choice, but I am on your side. This is classic populist language. This is the elite versus the people. And of course, this gets far, far worse under Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson, who treats the legislature with contempt, comes to when he's elected prime minister, he loses 6 votes in parliament in 6 days. You have the whole row over prorogation. You have that whole week or two when the government was openly toying with the idea of ignoring legislation passed to prevent a no-deal Brexit. There was a political point to this. Boris Johnson wasn't just doing this for the fun of it, because what he had to do was A, rally Leave voters, and as I said earlier, he was very successful in this, and B, by portraying Parliament as a constraint, he was making the case for the early general election that he craved and eventually got. But the language that was used was absolutely remarkable. The manifesto, the Conservative Party manifesto of December 2019 said, the UK is paralysed by a broken parliament that simply refuses to deliver Brexit. And it went on to criticise MPs who have devoted themselves to thwarting the democratic decision of the British people, opening up a destabilising and potentially extremely damaging rift between politicians and the people. This is classic populist rhetoric, and it's classic populist rhetoric deployed by people from supposedly mainstream parties. And it starts to have a resonance. The Hansard audit of democratic engagement, which they do every year, which is a massive survey on the health of our democracy, found in 2019 that 54% of Britons agreed that Britain needs a strong leader willing to break the rules. 43% expressed a preference for political parties and leaders with radical ideas for change who haven't been in power before. 42% felt that many of the country's problems can be dealt with more effectively if the government didn't have to worry so much about votes in Parliament. So you see this being reflected back, the increasingly populist language of politicians being reflected back in the increasingly populist views of the British public. And this should come as no surprise to any of you. What we have seen is a steady decline in trust in politics. And if you think about it, over this period, this roughly 10-year period, the British public had serially expressed their desire for profound change. 4 million people did it by voting for UKIP in 2015. We have the Leave vote in 2016. We have a massive vote for Jeremy Corbyn in 2017. The vote for Boris Johnson in 2019 was partly a kind of we need to change the way we do things vote. And of course, Labour's manifesto in 2024 had that rather silly title, Change. Don't know what sort of change and what it means or anything, but it said change. It captured the mood of the people. The British people had serially voted for things to be done differently, and politics had failed to deliver. And of course, in the background, you know, I know there's a lot of talk nowadays that this sort of flirting with populism is down to things like the small boats, but I actually think there is the real reason, that actually we have this long sustained period of economic underperformance that means that British people have felt themselves, if not getting poorer, then certainly getting no richer. We've been through a period of almost 20 years during which median wages in this country have barely grown at all. So this is the picture we find ourselves in. And just in case you think, bloody hell, this is depressing, it's about to get worse. Because these things are compounded now by the fact that we find ourselves in an international situation where not only is the global trading system under threat, Donald Trump et al., but also we are dealing with increasing levels of geopolitical instability. Now, those things are bad in their own way, but from a British point of view, they have significant consequences because, of course, let me just say one thing about the tariff. I mean, the tariffs I know look low there compared to the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s. But what I would say is in the 1930s, when the US did that, the US hardly traded with the world. So actually, they had relatively little impact on trade. By the time you get Trump increasing tariffs now, the US trades far more with the rest of the world than it did back in the 1930s. So the impact is disproportionate. The point for us is we're a relatively small, relatively open economy, which means that an increase in tariffs has an impact on our economy. And of course, being outside the European Union and having to stand and watch as the European Union and the United States engage in subsidy wars while they plow money to support domestic industries, being outside becomes quite an uncomfortable place to be. I mean, this is no fault of any of the Brexiters who didn't have crystal balls, but it is hard to imagine a worse moment in the history of international trade to have decided to leave a continental-sized economy to go your own way because of the direction of international trade thereafter. And the geopolitical uncertainty I mentioned also had significant implications for us. If you want a graph that basically sums up the political economy of Western Europe since the Korean War, that's it. We have basically slashed spending on defense, and we've slashed spending on defense to enable ourselves to spend more on welfare, and in this case, health. Now, President Trump has insisted that all NATO member states should be spending 3.5% of GDP on defense. And Keir Starmer has, in a very Keir Starmer, slightly woolly way, said that we will get to 3.5% sometime in the next parliament, which is a good trick. Anyway, the projection is that we will get to 3.5% of GDP on defense by about 2032. The last time this country spent 3.5% of GDP on defense was in 1988, when spending on health was 4.2% of GDP. In 2032, when we're next meant to reach 3.5% of GDP on defense, spending on the NHS will be 9.3% of GDP. There are massive fiscal trade-offs still to be made, well beyond Rachel Reeves' budget at the end of this month, to incorporate our response to an increasingly uncertain geopolitical situation. And of course, added to this, we have the sad fact that Brexit, voted for by a lot of people, partly as a protest to the fact that the economy wasn't working for them, has made the economy weaker still. The numbers, I mean, economists love putting numbers on things. The numbers always strike me as slightly a bit of a guess. The fact is, we now have enough data to know that both in terms of goods trade and services trade, Brexit has had a significant impact on our economy. We talk a lot about productivity in this country. The one way you can guarantee to slow productivity growth is to decrease your openness to external competition, which is what Brexit has done. So that's going to impact on those OBR figures about productivity. And if nothing else, what that table shows you, and I'm sorry to get all technical on you, but this is like a law. You trade more with people who are closer to you. Okay? You can sign as many trade deals as you want with the Chinese, with the Indians, with the Australians. It was true, I think, until 2011, that the UK, until 2011, traded more with the Republic of Ireland than it did with Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa combined. And that's not because the Irish economy was growing faster than the Chinese one. It's not because the Irish economy was the future of the world economy. It's because the Irish economy is next door. And that is something it is very, very hard to move away from. So just quickly, let me talk about Keir Starmer's much vaunted reset. Now, I'm going to be quite cynical about the reset, so let me preface my remarks by saying that actually, you know, things have moved on a long way. It was only just over 3 years ago, during the Conservative leadership contest, that Liz Truss was asked whether France was a friend or a foe and couldn't answer. Okay, so in that sense, at least, we've seen a massive shift in the tone of our relationship with not only the European Union, but with the individual member states of the European Union as well. However, despite all the fanfares that surrounded that summit back in May this year, the only thing that the two sides actually agreed on, apart from a security and defense pact, was fisheries. And whilst that's great, if you're into fish or if you're a fisher, the fisheries industry contributes less than Harrods to our economy every year. So if you're looking for aggregate growth, a deal on fisheries with the EU is not the place to get it. Now, we've agreed that we will negotiate with them a deal on agriculture, a deal on electricity trading, and a deal on emissions trading, which is all to the good and will remove some of the frictions to trade. However, these are things we're aspiring to rather than things we have done. And one of the problems we're going to face going forward is that the EU clearly no longer regards us as a priority. It is far from clear to me that these negotiations will be successful. Certainly not clear to me that they'll be successful on the timescale laid out by Nick Thomas-Simmons, who I think gave this lecture last year, who said that he wants the agricultural deal to be in place and working by 2027. I fear that Nick Thomas-Simmons has never negotiated with the European Union before, because that strikes me as a very, very compressed timeline. And even if we get everything we want, We get the electricity, we get the emissions trading, we get the agriculture. The government's own economic assessment reckons this will gain us about 0.5, 0.6% of GDP. So in the greater scheme of things, in the scheme of that ballpark 4% figure that the OBR talks about as a Brexit impact, it's relatively small beer. And this is where the problems start in a way, because to do more, the costs of Brexit are tied up in the decision to leave the single market and the customs union. That's where the real economic gains are to be had. Now here, the British government is saying, well, once we've done agriculture and once we've done emissions trading, maybe we can have a bit of chemicals as well. That would be nice, wouldn't it? And maybe we could have a couple of other sectors. The problem with this is that the EU doesn't want us to do that. The EU has been quite clear, you can do this stuff, but after this, you have a choice. You either rejoin the single market or you stay where you are. We don't want you, in their phrase, cherry picking. Remember, the European Union has no interest in making Brexit work. European political leaders facing populist challenges of their own have no interest in seeing Britain flourishing outside the European Union, where they're facing challenges at home from people who are saying, why are we submitting ourselves to all these EU laws? So the EU will play hardball. And on our side, the government has got those two clear red lines. We will not rejoin the single market. We will not rejoin the customs union. So even if this reset works, even if we negotiate everything we're meant to reset, and my lord, there are road bumps on the way, the EU, for instance, will make youth mobility a condition of all these other things. And the British government and the EU are miles apart in terms of numbers, in terms of duration of stay, in terms of what happens on university fees, in terms of NHS surcharges and things like this. So I hope that the negotiations succeed. I would say it's far from a foregone conclusion that they will. But even if all of that goes well, the relative economic impact of this will be quite small, and it'll be quite small because of the red lines we have. Now, you might say, we have a government, a sensible, centrist, level-headed lawyer in charge of our government, no less, with a massive majority, so why can't they be bolder? It's a very good question, but one of the reasons they can't be bolder, and I mentioned to you earlier that 2005 saw the government elected on the smallest ever vote share by a government. That was until last year. Keir Starmer pulled off something quite remarkable in the election last year by getting a majority as big as he did on the back of a vote share of under 34% of the British people. My friend and colleague Rob Ford wrote a lovely piece after the election in which he said, what Labour have done is create the tallest, wobbliest electoral Jenga tower we have ever seen. And what he meant by that was that Labour lost votes in the constituencies they already held. Keir Starmer lost votes in Holborn and St Pancras. And actually, as a curious parallel, when Tony Blair was elected in 1997, even though he already had a huge majority in Sedgefield, he gained 10,000 votes in Sedgefield the year he won. Keir Starmer lost votes. David Lammy lost votes. West Streeting almost lost too many votes. He's got a majority of 500 now. Labour lost votes where it was already winning, but managed to gain them where it needed them to beat the Conservatives. Hence this idea of a Jenga tower. It's very, very tall, but the foundations are incredibly weak. This always strikes me as the most remarkable graphic. That is, Labour voters asked, why did you vote Labour at the 2024 election? 49% of them say to get the Tories out. In other words, the election of 2024 was not an election about people being enthusiastic about Labour. It was an election about people being desperate to get rid of the Conservatives. So what we have is a government that is already very unpopular, and it's already very unpopular not through its own actions. It hasn't done anything as bad as to justify the poll ratings they have at the moment, but you've got to think about it. This government comes at the end of the story that I've just told you, a story of progressively growing disillusionment with both politics and the economic state of the country that has been bubbling away for almost a quarter of a century now. And that is the dilemma that Keir Starmer faces, is he's facing a whole raft of long-term problems that we just haven't addressed properly for a long time. But the public are impatient and want to see answers and outcomes now. One of the corollaries of a hemorrhaging of trust in politics is that people do not give politicians the benefit of the doubt if they say things like, this will take a while, bear with us, we need to spend several years doing this because we can't turn around these problems overnight. All those things are true, but the public has very little appetite for them simply because we've lived through this period of ebbing faith in politics, ebbing trust in politicians to deliver, a growing sense that politicians are in it for themselves and not in it for the country as a whole. And as a result, we're here. Thought I'd end on a high point. Now, let me say a couple of things about this. Firstly, the next election is 4 years away, or just under 4 years away. And 4 years is an eternity. In 4 years' time, President Trump might no longer be President of the United States, though, who knows? He shouldn't be President of the United States in 4 years' time, let me say that. 4 years ago, Boris Johnson was unbeatable. Tim Shipman wrote that piece on that thing on Twitter saying Boris Johnson squats like a toad across British politics and no one can move him. 4 years ago, Keir Starmer was considering his position as leader of the Labour Party because he'd been hammered in Hartlepool. So an awful lot can change. This isn't a foregone conclusion. I'm not saying reform will win the next election. But the polls look bad and Labour is very, very unpopular. And part of this is about the fact, just to go back to Brexit, Brexit in a sense both reflected prevailing discontent that had built up by 2016, and also, I think, represented a really unique opportunity to try and challenge that discontent and respond to that discontent, because politics all of a sudden got it. When people used to ask me, what do you think is the most positive thing about Brexit? I used to say, people are talking about stuff they should have been talking about 10 years ago. People have noticed that the North isn't doing very well. People have realized that just because national GDP is growing, it doesn't mean that people in Sunderland are doing particularly well. People, you know, in the aftermath of the referendum, I used to laugh about the fact that, you know, the BBC was sending correspondents up to Hartlepool and whatever. And I used to laugh that it was a bit like a David Attenborough show, you know. It's like, here is the lever. And it was like this sort of weird creature that we'd never really thought about before. And finally, we were thinking about them. And so Brexit opened that door of possibility. But it was an opportunity that was squandered. And I think the British people have made their point repeatedly. As I said, they have voted repeatedly, openly, and obviously for a change. And when that change hasn't materialized, that has spilled over into dissatisfaction and a lack of trust in mainstream politics. I'm going to get rid of that. So I'm going to put that slide on because that is the closest I'm coming to a slide on law. That is me with a law. Okay? So this now is a legal lecture. As we reach the 11th hour. They're absolutely weird, the stuff they print those laws on, that vellum. It's absolutely strange stuff. But anyway, that was one of the highlights of my Brexit years. So where are we now? We're in a position where we have a government with a massive majority that is governing from a position of a defensive crouch. It's in a defensive crouch for a load of reasons, partly because of the fragility of that majority, partly because you have a government that clearly doesn't have any politics to it, has no vision for the country, nowhere to go. But it is a government that needs to find something that looks like solutions to long-term structural problems and to do it in a ridiculously short space of time, which isn't fair, but is a reflection on how long we have waited for those solutions to be put in place. And I think Brexit in that context stands as a testament both to the levels of discontent. Brexit was about political failure pre-2016. It was about a failure to understand how dissatisfied people were before. And the absence of a response to that referendum that sent such a clear signal was, I think, another massive political failure we might come to reject, to regret. Thank you very much indeed.